is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, Bob and Marilyn Schumann, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Coming up on this week's Environment Show, a single-celled organism, Pfizeria piscicida, is killing fish and stripping their flesh in some coastal areas. Scientists still don't know how it works. We look at the issues Clinton is wrestling with as he prepares for the conference on global warming this December. A naturalist presents a portrait of a creek which flows into Lake Ontario. Glaciers shaped it, but salmon are changing it, not by themselves, but by the people who come to fish. And in the Earth calendar, we join the Sandhill Cranes as they pass through Indiana on their way south. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. Periodically, nature reminds us that despite all of our scientific research and well-equipped laboratories, she has many secrets we still don't understand. Such is the case with Pfizeria piscicida. That's the single-celled organism that has caused an outbreak of fish die-offs and lesions on the bodies of fish in some rivers which are flowing both into the Chesapeake Bay and other estuarine areas on the mid-Atlantic coast. Most of the time, the organism is harmless, and then for reasons not clearly understood, it changes, much as a caterpillar changes to a butterfly. It can change into forms which release toxins that kill fish or strip flesh from the fish's bodies, causing ugly sores. Tom Simpson is professor and coordinator of the Chesapeake Bay Agricultural Program for the University of Maryland. He describes the process.
The organism is very complex. It has 24 life stages, of which most are harmless. Most of the time, it's swimming around, eating algae or bacteria, and not bothering anything. There are three or four life stages in which it lies as a cyst in the sediment, but then there are also three or four life stages where it goes into a toxic form, where it excretes a group of toxins into the water. Some are neurotoxins that stun fish. Others eat away at the flesh of the fish. And it is when it's in these toxic stages that, of course, we get the large fish kills.
Simpson says it may be that fish themselves cause the Pfizeria to convert to a toxic form.
It is not clearly understood all the elements that cause it to go into the toxic stages, but certainly one of those is that there's a large fish biomass. Fish excrete or secrete materials that seem to cause the organism to go into the toxic stage. It also requires high levels of algae, high levels of nutrient enrichment, relatively warm water, and generally shallow and sluggish or slow-moving water. It prefers moderate salinity, although it has been found in fresh and oceanic water. It's only been found in toxic stages in moderate salinity.
Scientists are trying to identify the toxins which the Pfizeria generate so they can tell whether a fish kill or a lesion on a fish's body indicates the presence of the organism. While Pfizeria have existed in ecosystems for a long time, the organism was only discovered a decade ago by University of North Carolina researcher Joanne Burkholder. Thus, the scientific knowledge base is slim. Baymen who have made their living fishing in the Chesapeake Bay for generations report having seen sores and fish kills before, particularly in a species called menhaden, but they've never seen anything like the die-offs of last summer. Officials at the Maryland Department of Agriculture say eating seafood from waters with Pfizeria does not present health problems for humans. But Michael Hirschfeld, Vice President for Resource Protection at the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, says Pfizeria-contaminated water itself can be a threat to human health.
There's now documented evidence from a couple of studies at the University of Maryland and Johns Hopkins Medical Schools that say that people who get water splashed on them or who even breathe the air over an area where Pfizeria is active in attacking fish can get everything from similar kinds of sores or lesions on their bodies to having effects on memory and learning functions.
Researchers are trying to identify causes of Fusteria outbreaks, and one possible cause is increased nitrogen and phosphorus running off the land. Suspect sources include factory chicken farming operations in Maryland and hog farming in North Carolina, which produce large amounts of manure, which is then spread on farm fields. Dr. Simpson from the University of Maryland says that new research shows that while phosphorus was thought to bind to the soil, it will run off, even if there is no soil erosion, when large amounts are applied.
We really don't have enough scientific evidence to know exactly what the link between nutrients and Fusteria is. There's substantial circumstantial evidence, and Dr. Joanne Burkholder at North Carolina State University has done some work indicating that Fusteria seems to like high phosphorus levels. We do not have conclusive scientific evidence on that. We do know in the Chesapeake Bay that our algal growth, the eutrophication or low oxygen problems that we've been fighting for decades, are tied to both phosphorus and nitrogen. In the fresher waters, in shallower waters, phosphorus is frequently what limits algae growth, whereas in the saltier waters and in the deep trench of the bay, nitrogen limits algae growth. Fusteria, on the other hand, the limited amount of current science would indicate that phosphorus may be more important.
While scientists try to find the exact cause of the Fusteria outbreaks, environmental lawyers say that laws designed to prevent the runoff into estuaries and bays have been underfunded and inadequately enforced. In 1990, Congress adopted a program that would require states to take action to control runoff in coastal areas. Tim Eichenberg, program counsel for the Center for Marine Conservation and co-chair of the Clean Water Network, says progress is lacking.
The program has not been completed. It's been woefully underfunded, hasn't been funded for the last 2 years, and this year Congress and the House has only appropriated $1 million nationwide for this program, and the Senate has not appropriated any money for it. So there is a good program on the books in coastal areas, which is where the Fusteria has been shown to exist, but it is not being funded properly, and states are not making progress in submitting and completing these supposedly enforceable management plans.
In coming months, scientists expect to learn a lot more about the single-celled Fusteria, but to date it's presented a huge challenge to a lot of multi-celled human scientists. You can trace their progress on the University of Maryland website. Find it by searching University of Maryland C. Grant. Global warming is the focus of meetings at the White House and throughout Washington. It's all in preparation for the Climate Change Conference to be held in Kyoto, Japan this December. During the course of the next few months, the Environment Show will air a series of reports and discussions relating to global warming. In our first report of the series, the Environment Show's Stephen Westcott looks at what some at the center of the global warming debate are saying about the predicted changes in our climate, and what they say needs to be done to slow the trend.
At the Kyoto Conference, scientists will be advising the world's governments on the issue of global warming and the possible effects resulting from changes in the climate. Specifically, the severity of climatological impacts is just one of the many issues that will be addressed. Henry Kendall is professor of physics at MIT and chairman of the Union of Concerned Scientists. He is one of many scientists advising the Clinton administration on the issue of global warming. He says carbon dioxide levels are increasing and affecting world climate.
Well, the authoritative view, and there's a broad consensus among experts in the area, is that there is now a probable increase in the global surface temperature, the air temperatures, or will be, by about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of next century, with a possible range of about 4 degrees or so. And the conclusion also is that there is a discernible human influence on the global climate. And the warming is likely to be greater than any that has been experienced on the Earth for the last 10,000 years.
Professor Kendall says the burning of fossil fuels, cutting down and burning of temperate rainforests, and the overall increase of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere are the major contributing factors to global warming. Kendall says there are some signs the global climate is changing, but stresses these changes will become more noticeable.
And what it can result in is increased temperatures, changes in rainfall patterns, possible drought in continental interiors, rising sea levels throughout the world, storms of greater severity, and following on, these changes are major consequences on ecosystems, on living systems, many of which we depend on.
Professor Kendall says both developing and technologically advanced countries need to take responsibility for controlling emissions and the atmospheric difficulties many are predicting. Creating automobiles with little, if any, carbon emissions is just one of the popular themes in the push for reducing carbon emissions. Volvo Truck Corporation is now testing a new hybrid truck that combines diesel with electric power, and Toyota is planning on putting out a hybrid fuel cell in some Corolla models next year. Kelly Sims, science policy director with Ozone Action, based in Washington, D.C., says this shows the American automakers have some catching up to do.
But what I think is remarkable is that they're going to be able to market this Corolla in the United States for $16,000, which is almost exactly the same price of a Corolla today. And American car makers are nowhere near being able to put something like that out on the road. So I fear that we're in a similar situation to the one we were in the 1970s when we had the oil shocks. And the European car companies and the Japanese car companies were much more ready to capitalize on a market that was hungry for fuel-efficient technology than we were.
But Sim says getting American companies to produce eco-friendly products is not going to be easy. She says not surprisingly, the companies with direct interest are putting up the biggest fight.
The fossil fuel industry has launched a great deal of television advertisements. They launched a $13 million campaign last month to oppose any action on climate change. And we just don't have the resources and the public interest community to be able to combat something like that. And they're spreading a lot of misinformation about the science and the costs of reducing emissions. And that's very hard to combat because, you know, we just can't possibly afford to spend that much money on advertisements.
Just recently, a group called Coalition for Vehicle Choice took out a three-page ad in the Washington Post urging President Clinton not to sign the treaty. However, there is little record of such a group's existence. Groups on both sides of the economic issue have released their own reports on how technological changes will impact the American economy. While industry supporters say the Kyoto Treaty will have harmful effects, other economists say cheaper energy costs will make the market more competitive. The Energy Department recently released a report looking at how new energy technologies could reduce emissions and have little impact on the economy. Moreover, the U.S. government will not only have to persuade companies here to reduce emissions, but encourage foreign governments and companies to join the effort, something the American government has not done, according to Dr. Jane Lubchenco, a professor of zoology and marine biology at Oregon State University.
We signed the Framework Convention on Climate Change, indicated our willingness, our intent to act on that. We have not really lived up to that promise. And we need to really get on with things. The challenge has been to move from the current dependence on fossil fuels to alternate sources of energy. The reality is that the technology is in hand to do that.
Professor Lubchenco says the U.S. government has been a follower more than a leader in efforts to combat global warming, a role she hopes will soon change. Lubchenco also hopes people understand the potential dangers of the economic arguments that suggest a wait-until-later strategy. She says waiting to solve the problem could increase the chances of more disruptive changes down the road. I'm Stephen Westcott for The Environment Show.
I'm Peter Burley, and the Environment Show wants to hear from you.
call us at 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Our email address is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. You can find us on the web. Our website is www.enn.com/envshow. There you can hear us anytime. Again, the address is www.enn.com/envshow. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. Naturalist John Weeks paints a portrait of the Oak Orchard River and tells how it is shaped by time and people.
The Oak Orchard River cuts a slightly winding path through the western extremities of Orleans County in western New York. Its fount is found in the northwest corner of the county, an enormous expanse of shallow marshes and swamp forests. The thin veneer of muckland soils proved too unpromising to justify the cost of drainage. The path the river follows traverses a combination of low glacial moraines and flat, silty plains deposited by the huge lake which covered a good portion of the county during the last glacial retreat. In my youth, the stream was known as Oak Orchard Creek, Crick we called it, and for the first few miles of its existence, it is still Crick today. It meanders through a flat countryside where agriculture is still the primary land use. Flat is relative, of course. We're not talking about tabletop flatness. There is a gentle roll to the land, but it is still a countryside where the horizons are defined by hedgerows, shade trees, and silos, not hills. Near the little hamlet of Kenyonville, the stream makes a dramatic change, broadening and slowing down. We have to travel a few extra miles downstream to understand this. At this point, a cap of limestone prevents the gradual and orderly erosion of the sandstones and shales which underlay the glacial till. The result is a precipitous scarp. Far below this resistant cap, the river has cut deeply through the underlying rocks, creating a gorge which characterizes the riverbed from that point until it reaches the backwaters of Lake Ontario. Falling water is endowed with the capacity to do work. So it should not surprise us that a local utility has seen fit to locate a hydroelectric plant there. As is often the case in such developments, a dam was also created to provide water storage for times of low stream flow. This creates a large reservoir, which is little more than estuary by the time it reaches back to Kenyonville. Below the dam and waterfall, the creek becomes a river. The last 6 miles of its course, it follows a deeply cut, picturesque valley, its tree-clad embankments soaring over 100 feet above the river. The valley itself is narrow. Still, the stream is endowed with sloughs and backwaters, screened by maples and willows, in places beautiful enough to catch the fancy of both naturalist and artist. It was there I had my first exposure to the wilds of mink, muskrat, raccoon, and fox, or to the nesting habits of rails, herons, redwings, marsh wrens, and swamp sparrows, to mention only a few of the many I observed. I fished there with my brothers. I sketched there with my artist father. And best of all, I made many solo trips to observe and take notes. The upper reaches of that stream seemed wild and remote in those days, with only an occasional intrusion by someone who maintained a camp on the rim of the escarpment, and who by one means or another arranged to get from camp down to the river. The introduction of salmon into Lake Ontario has combined with the scarcity of good campsites to completely revise the value of this pretty gorge. It is occupied now in a way that many would have thought impossible 40 years ago. I don't really regret that. It would be a futile exercise anyway. But it is time that a very careful survey of natural as well as recreational potentials be made so that the vigorous pursuit of the newfound does not overwhelm the important ecological role these specialized lake tributaries perform. Every lake is the product, the sum total, of all the contributions from its tributary streams. Its heritage depends upon the husbandry of its watershed. In protecting its beauty and its wildness, we can do a great deal to maintain the quality of the contribution which the Oak Orchard River makes to Lake Ontario.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. As we broadcast, sandhill cranes are stopping over at the Jasper Pulaski Fish and Wildlife Area in northwestern Indiana. Their journey to the south for the winter is in full swing. Jim Bergens manages the area.
We did a count today and counted over 6,000, so the migration is well underway. But the sandhill crane is a large bird, at least this particular one. These are the largest. Their full name is the eastern population of the greater sandhill crane. There are several subspecies of sandhill crane, and these guys are the largest. They stand about 3 feet tall, have a wingspan up to 7 feet, and weigh 10 to 12 pounds. Both sexes look alike, that is, their plumage is the same, which is basically a grayish or a bluish-grayish color with a red cap on top of their head.
Bergen says there are 15 species of cranes in the world, seven of which are endangered. The whooping crane is in the most danger of extinction. Sandhill cranes make a haunting sound. It's one that most people never forget.
It's a loud, guttural rattling. It doesn't have a lot of notes. It's not a song like you would hear a robin do. It's slightly more elaborate than a honk that you would hear a goose do. They're shorter notes, closer together. They're relatively high-pitched. They echo. You can hear them for miles on occasion. For instance, we can have birds that are in migration that are arriving here at the property, and we can hear them long before we can see them. They migrate in by using wind and thermals, and they glide, basically, but they migrate at high altitudes. And when they when they get close to Jasper Pulaski, they'll start a spiral descent toward the ground, and we can hear them long before we actually can make eye contact with them.
The birds now passing through Indiana spent the summer in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. Most of the rest of the sandhill flock was much farther north in the Arctic. Bergen says the birds stay in the wildlife area for several weeks before continuing their journey to southern Georgia and Florida.
They nest and roost in wetlands. Now, nesting, everybody probably pretty well understands. The roosting is a phenomenon that cranes use for protection from predators, and they actually stand in shallow marsh areas at night, and that's what's referred to as roosting. Now, during the day, they'll spend a much higher percentage of time in upland areas, areas without water. And once they're done roosting for the night, beginning at sunrise, the cranes will leave the fish and wildlife area and go out in all four directions surrounding the property where they'll feed and loaf during the day. So they do not eat fish like the great blue heron, although they'll eat other aquatic insects, invertebrates, frogs. They eat roots and tubers, berries, lots of seeds, some vegetative matter, root matter that they pick up both from wetlands and in upland fields.
In the fall, cranes travel in groups of 15 to 20. Bergen says that Jasper Pulaski is visited by 16,000 sandhill cranes every year, with 32,000 being the highest number recorded in one season. Weather conditions often determine the number of birds that will stop at the wildlife area. 40 to 50,000 people visit the refuge annually to view the birds. As to the number of those people heading south for the winter, Bergens didn't say. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. This is the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, the director of the Kenyan Wildlife Service says wildlife cannot be saved with parks alone. Only when people and wildlife live together can both be saved. We lock horns over the question of whether renewable energy sources like wind and solar really are a good idea. The Weather Service and the Old Farmer's Almanac both called for a mild winter, but they differ in the northern Midwest. Our ear to the ground sails on the Hudson with folk who love the river. These stories and more coming up. All of us have grown up with pictures of elephants and lions in Africa. We're also aware that the animals survive in big parks, such as those in Kenya. The parks themselves were established by the colonial government before it was driven from power. David Western is a Kenyan whose father was a big game hunting guide, killed by an elephant. Currently, he's a director of Kenya Wildlife Service, the government agency in charge of all parks and wildlife in that country. He's just written a book called In the Dust of Kilimanjaro, published by Island Press. He argues that parks alone cannot save wildlife in Africa, and that in the process of establishing parks, native populations who offer the only hope for saving the animals were alienated.
Wanyama na watu wanawezi kuishi pamoja.
That was David Western expressing in Swahili his strongly held belief that people and wildlife can live together.
I think the traditional concept in the Western world has been the separation of humanity and nature. I grew up among the Maasai, among other people, where in fact there was no such thing as wilderness. There was always wildlife and people together, though in different numbers. What intrigued me, and why I set out to look into that in Amboseli, was what essentially created that balance. Why did the Maasai live with wildlife? And two things very quickly became evident. Their migrations are identical. And they actually gave me cattle to try and convince me to see Amboseli through the eyes of a cow. And I quickly discovered that the milk heels they get from the cattle, and they live off the milk of their cattle, essentially gear them along the same migratory routes as wildlife. So you can't untangle either wildlife or migration routes in one ecosystem. Secondly, that in generations gone past, they actually use wildlife during the drought periods as what they call their second cattle. So that during the good periods, having recovered their own herds, they would look after wildlife as a drought resource.
And in your book, you describe a complicated and torturous road by which you tried to get public authorities to recognize that interdependence.
Yes, it's perhaps not surprising, because the approach seen largely by the colonial governments was that the enemy really was the local person on the ground. That person was the poacher. So the best thing to do is establish laws which prohibit any local hunting, or on the other hand, set aside national parks which exclude people. And that created a very deep resentment. So turning back the government picture of the local person on the ground as being the potential supporter of wildlife and ultimately the most important custodian was extremely torturous.
20 years ago, Western and his colleagues convinced the Kenyan government to re-involve the Maasai people in the Amboseli Park and to open up the boundaries so the migrating animals could move outside.
Policy explicitly recognized the limitations of the national parks, the needs to open up lands outside to wildlife, and in particular to make wildlife beneficial to local people. And in fact, that policy hasn't changed in Kenya over all the years. It's the same policy. The reason it didn't expand beyond Amboseli was largely the result of the decline, the collapse of the wildlife institution of those days, the Wildlife Conservation and Management Department.
Now, as you finish your book, you express some optimism about what locally based conservation can bring about. And I gather you take the view that the doomsayers may be wrong. How do you reflect on that circumstance?
One of the key and obviously understandable issues raised by the doomsday ecologist is rising human population and consumption. And I think by localizing the opportunity to benefit from wildlife, it actually mitigates against other forms of utilization which are more destructive to the land, because it's genuinely sustainable. So, for example, in areas just north of Maasai Mara, our best-known national reserve, a number of Maasai who had put their land under wheat, then found it more profitable for wildlife, so have gone back to wildlife and tourism income as a use of that land. So I think making that benefit available to them can put the choice in their hands to involve wildlife for their benefit. And I think that's honestly the only way I see going in many areas outside national parks.
Weston was an organizer of the campaign to ban the sale of ivory in international trade to reduce the poaching of elephants. He thinks controls are not in place to stop poaching if trade is resumed, even if restricted to countries where the elephant is not endangered. Given the pressures on wildlife in Africa, I asked him if he was optimistic.
Yes, I am, because as I detail in the book, I grew up during the colonial days when there was no hope for wildlife, or so it seemed, and the only way to do it, to conserve wildlife, was to set aside parks in a big rush before independence. Well, independence came and went, and surprisingly, more national parks were established. And I think the national governments have become very dedicated to conserving wildlife, but simply haven't understood the resentment that created on the ground. But now with the switch around, with the local benefits coming through, the movement of conservation towards grassroots involvement is winning local support, and in turn reinforcing government policies in this direction. So having seen the absolute disparate independence and the turnaround now, I remain fairly optimistic.
Weston has specific advice for Americans who want to go to Africa to see wildlife. He says don't just visit the national parks.
What we're saying is visit the areas outside national parks as well. Look at cultural diversity, historical diversity, the variety of different habitats. Because in essence, what that does is not only give the tourist a very different and more appealing type of safari, much more diverse, but it also engages them with local communities, using local guides, staying in very pleasant local cottages. And that money goes directly back to the local communities, who ultimately are the custodians of wildlife.
David Weston is director of the Kenya Wildlife Service, and his new book, In the Dust of Kilimanjaro, is published by Island Press. Conversion to renewable energy sources, wind power, solar, and biomass, which includes, of course, wood and agricultural residue, has been high on the agenda of environmentalists for years. The issue is of particular significance now as we debate the policies which the nation should be adopting to deal with global warming and in anticipation of the conference in Kyoto. Robert Bradley is president of the Institute for Energy Research. He's based in Houston, Texas, and is a scholar for the Cato Institute. And he has written to the effect that green fuels really don't make any sense. He locks horns with Paul Jeffereff. He's director of energy at the Union of Concerned Scientists and lecturer on sustainable development at Tufts University. So welcome, gentlemen. And the question is renewable energy expensive, environmentally counterproductive, and unsustainable? Mr. Bradley?
Interestingly, the environmental movement has rejected the most feasible renewable energy source to address alleged air pollution problems such as global warming, and that is hydroelectricity, which accounts for about 80% of the nation's renewable energy generation and consumption. This leaves other sources such as biomass, which is an air emission renewable, the burning of wood, geothermal, which has attracted a lot of opposition, including from Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt, because it's in protected areas and national parks and the like. So we're really down to wind and solar, which accounts for only 0.1% of U.S. electricity consumption. And when you look closely at wind and solar, they have significant environmental problems.
Mr. Jeffress, in response.
Well, it saddens me that Mr. Bradley and certain parts of the gas industry, although not all parts, should suddenly have become anti-environment. And I think it reveals more than anything else that they see renewable energy as a threat to their competitive advantage, which is a position that they needn't take. In order to argue that renewables are either not cost-effective or are environmentally damaging, Mr. Bradley has to take the worst examples of renewable energy performance, exaggerate and distort them out of all proportion, and then extrapolate to the whole industry and to the future. Whereas for fossil fuels, he does exactly the opposite. He glosses over massive embedded environmental problems in the whole infrastructure of the industry. And at no stage does he directly compare the overall effects of fossil with renewable energy.
Okay, Mr. Bradley, in response.
Well, we have a little bit of schizophrenia here. I can say I favor renewable energy in the sense that I think hydroelectricity, which accounts for 80% of U.S. Production, is something that should be counted on to address air emission problems. It's the 0.1%, the solar and wind, that is so radically uneconomic and which has environmental problems, wind power in particular, which was labeled by an official of the Sierra Club as the Cuisinarts of the air.
Okay, Mr. Jeffreth, the last word on this one.
Well, comparing wind and solar power unfavorably with fossil fuels on an environmental basis is like comparing the damage caused by a bicycle with the damage caused by a jet aircraft or a diesel truck. It's simply a false comparison and one that the mainstream scientific community would flatly refute.
Okay, well, let's go to another aspect of this. Can you compare the costs of various fuels when the environmental costs of dirty air or the loss of fisheries or logging really are not figured into the fuel prices? Mr. Jeffreth, what do you think?
I think the answer is that you absolutely cannot compare them on a level playing field basis. Fossil fuel prices right now ignore the fact that air pollution kills more people every year than drunk drivers do. It ignores the fact that scientists around the world have reached consensus that global warming caused by fossil fuel emissions is a very serious problem that will extend into the next century for our children and for our children's children.
Mr. Bradley, I gather you would have a different view.
Yes, in my Cato paper, I document how natural gas outcompetes wind and solar even when you add externality adders. I use some adders that are used by the Natural Resources Defense Council and the California Energy Commission, and wind and solar still can't compete. And ironically, wind and solar farms contribute to global warming in the short run because of their massive use of steel, concrete, and glass, much more than with natural gas infrastructure.
Mr. Jeffreth, in response.
It's a ridiculous comparison to compare the one-time use of energy in producing the materials for renewable plants with the ongoing use of fossil fuel throughout the year and throughout the decades. In addition to which, the global warming gases that are used, that result from producing renewable energy equipment come from the fact that we use fossil fuel in the first place.
All right, Mr. Bradley, I guess yours is the last word.
Boy, if you think renewable energy is expensive now, imagine if we have a carbon tax that would increase electricity rates that go into all the cement, glass, and steel that go into solar and wind infrastructure. It's prohibitively inexpensive. It's a very poor use of the environmental dollar.
Okay. Quickly, in summary, again, let's start with you, Mr. Jeffreth, as Director of Energy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. How do you sum up where we are on this one?
Well, in addition to seriously distorting the truth about renewable energy, I think Mr. Bradley is also picking the wrong fight. He shouldn't be attacking renewable energy. He should be attacking coal and oil and unsafe nuclear plants. These are the real threats to our economy and our environment. There is a place for natural gas and for renewables in the energy mix of the future, and we have a great opportunity with bills now pending in Congress to support new technologies, slow global warming, create jobs, and mitigate health and environmental damage by a number of means, requiring old coal plants to meet emission standards comparable to new plants. Even following Mr. Bradley's own suggestion that we impose a carbon tax, the price impact from that would not come from the materials that go into producing nuclear, into producing renewable equipment. The price increases would come from the fact that those taxes would be imposed on fossil fuels.
All right, Mr. Bradley, I think
that would quickly result in a shift towards renewable.
We're going to ask you to sum up in our remaining few moments.
What is so interesting is that natural gas, advances with natural gas technology, has made wind and solar obsolete. Natural gas outcompetes wind and solar in 5 of 6 environmental categories: noise, visual blight, land disturbance, wildlife disturbance, and frontier air pollution.
Okay, well, I want to thank you both. We've heard Robert Bradley, who is president of the Institute for Energy Research in Houston and a scholar for the Cato Institute, and Paul Jeffreth, who is Director of Energy at the Union of Concerned Scientists in Boston, which is a national environmental group. We'd like to hear what you think about renewable energy. Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. This is The Environment Show, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. As winter approaches, weather forecasts abound. You can get the latest from the Weather Channel or your local radio forecaster, the National Weather Service website, or the Old Farmer's Almanac, available at the bookstore or at your convenience store. While the National Weather Service and the Old Farmer's Almanac use different methods to determine forecasts, this year they have similar long-range predictions. The Environment Show's Rachel Phillips has more.
The National Weather Service says that, from a temperature perspective, the northern half of the continental United States will find it mild during December, January, and March. Ed Olenek is a meteorologist and head of the Extended Range Forecast Operation for the National Weather Service.
And our forecast for that three-month period calls for above-normal temperatures over the northern half of the country, including New England, the northern sections of the Middle Atlantic states, the Great Lakes, the central and northern Great Plains, the Northwest, and virtually the entire West, roughly, from western Utah and western Arizona westward to the coast.
The National Weather Service lacks enough information about temperature to make predictions for the south and southeastern United States this year. Olenek says the average climate might be your best bet for those regions. Meanwhile, some regions will see more rain and snow December through February.
We're calling for above normal precipitation for California, the Southwest, Texas, up into the central Great Plains, the Gulf Coast states, and coastal regions of the Middle Atlantic states up through the Carolinas. As we get deeper into the winter, cold temperatures show up in the southeast and the south. Warm temperatures continue from New England across the Great Lakes into the west. The precipitation signal that I described earlier is actually stronger during January, February, and March.
According to Olenek, Montana, Wyoming, the Tennessee Valley, Ohio Valley, and western New York State will be drier than normal, and it will be warmer than normal in New England during the early part of the season. Olenek says among all the variables involved in weather predictions, El Nino is the largest contributing factor this year.
Primarily because it's the difference in temperature between the poles and the equator that actually drives the atmosphere and makes it move, causes the storms. When you enhance that temperature difference by warming up the equator east of the dateline, such as is happening this year, you intensify atmospheric motions, the energy in the atmosphere that's available for storms, and that's one of the reasons why El Nino is so important.
El Nino also plays a role in weather predictions of the Old Farmer's Almanac, according to managing editor Susan Peary. She sees a winter which will be one of the warmest on record, apparently agreeing with the mild predictions of the Weather Service. But unlike the Weather Service, the Almanac predicts some severe cold in some parts of the West later on.
We think for most of the West, or the western, you know, half of the country, the winter is going to start off mild in November and December, and then turn quite cold and stormy January through March. In the northern part, the Dakotas, south to Nebraska and Kansas, and west all the way to the Pacific Northwest, we're looking for really cold, stormy temperatures, particularly in February.
Peary says the pattern will continue in the country's midsection.
The plains will have a lot of that cold weather in January, February, and March. As you get a little closer to the Mississippi River, into the, you know, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, those kind of states that border the Mississippi, we're looking for increasingly milder winter, maybe starting off a little chillier and then being compared to relatively mild in what are traditionally the very coldest, stormiest months of January and February.
Like the Weather Service, the Almanac sees warm weather in the Northeast in November, calls for snowstorms in December, but less snow than usual in the mid-Atlantic states. Apparently, the Almanac and the Weather Service agree on more precipitation in the Southeast between January through March. Mark Twain once said, "Everybody talks about the weather, but nobody does anything about it." When the Weather Service and the Almanac talk about this winter, they agree in some areas, and in others they don't. Puri says the Old Farmer's Almanac has an 80% accuracy rate. Not knowing quite what that means, we can't compare it with the Weather Service, but we expect both forecasts for the coming winter have some validity. After all, even a stopped clock is right twice a day. For the Environment Show, I'm Rachel Phillips.
The Environment Show wants to hear from you. Our email address is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org.
I'm Linda Anderson, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, setting sail on the Clearwater.
Stay on the throat! Everybody here, take one step forward and bring the line with you! Take another step forward and bring the line with you! Okay, take one more step, bringing the line with you. Okay, drop the line!
Sails up, and the Clearwater heads south out of Albany, New York, for a 3-hour tour on the Hudson River. There's not much of a wind, and the boat, a 106-foot wooden sailing sloop, gently rocks on the calm waters. Designed after Dutch sloops of the 18th and 19th centuries, the Clearwater is the brainchild of folk singer Pete Seeger and friends. Believing that individuals can make a difference, the Clearwater was created to focus people's attention on the Hudson River. Since 1969, the sloop has served as a movable classroom, laboratory, and stage, bringing nearly 20,000 children and adults on board each year. Christopher Bowser is the boat's environmental educator.
We have different kinds of programs for different kinds of groups, whatever people request. We like to talk to the teachers and see what they want to teach. We have a great program that we run called the Classroom of the Waves, which is centered on leave the dock, do a little fishing, some sampling to see what's in the water as far as the aquatic life there, raise the sails, get the whole group, whomever has on, to help raise those sails up, and then split up into 5 stations. It might be plankton, or water chemistry, or mechanical advantage, the physics of sailing, navigation, fish. It can be a variety of different things.
The instruction happens all along the Hudson, from as far north as Albany to New York Harbor and Long Island Sound. With help from volunteers and staff members, the Clearwater, which is more than just the boat, is an organization which pursues strategies to improve water quality, protect critical habitat, promote water conservation, and clean up toxic waste so the Hudson River can be safe for the millions who live along its shore. Chris Bowser.
I think on the Hudson River, what it really boils down to is that what's good for the Hudson River is good for the people who live along the river, because they depend on the river for a lot of things. A lot of people get their drinking water from the river still. Still an extremely important avenue of transportation. Unfortunately, the once prevalent fishing industry is now just a fraction of what it was due to the level of PCBs in the water, which is too bad, because in the 1970s, this was a $40 million industry. And now in the 1990s, as we approach the 21st century, fishing is all but unallowable.
PCBs remain the river's biggest source of contamination, and the group supports the idea of dredging. In addition to its education and advocacy roles, the Clearwater is about celebration. From its great Hudson River Revival in June, a big waterfront festival that includes music, dance, folk arts, and crafts, to other events like a Shad and Pumpkin Festival, the Clearwater brings many the message that the river is a place to enjoy, which is certainly a sentiment shared by the crew of the ship. As one member said, "We do a lot of neat stuff." Keeping with the tradition of women captains serving on the Clearwater is Joy Oblix. She's been captain for around 20 months and describes the crew.
We have a great program with apprenticeship program, volunteers, interns, and then some paid crew. We have about 3 paid crew on board at any time, plus a captain and a cook, and an educator. But as far as total, we can sleep about 18 people semi-comfortably. So with the volunteers and everyone else, we might have as many as 15 on board.
A gentle breeze picks up as the sun sets. Light from the galley below glows through the boat's skylight, and long lines of light reflect on the water that is now turning ink black with the night. Along the shore, commuters rush on the highway, unsuspecting of another world that lies within reach. Come to the river, Chris Bowser says, and check it out. With Ear to the Ground, I'm Linda Anderson.
Starts high in the mountains of the north, crystal clear and icy trickles fall. Wrappers of chewing gum dropped by some hikers, born of things to come. Ashland's boss, 5,000 honest hands work at the consolidated.
Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. You can't go to Africa without a copy of this tape. Call 1-888-49-GREEN and order show number 406. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Chartok is the executive producer. Producers are Rachel Phillips and Stephen Westcott. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver and Jenny Donaldson Charitable Trust, Bob and Marilyn Schumann, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.